Truth, Lies, and Self-Deception was presented by Peter Wieringa on September 12, 2010 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Today, I'm going to teach on something a little bit different, something different than anything I've quite done before. And for my own ease, if you will, I'm probably going to read most of my notes. I've written down what I have to say. I'm not sure that I've got it outlined well enough in my mind to cover the whole thing. So I'm probably going to read most of it, make some other observations. I'll probably depart from the notes from time to time. But what I wanted to talk about today was I've been thinking a lot over the last couple of months about the whole idea of what is truth all about, what is self-deception all about, what are lies and lying all about, thinking a lot about some of those ideas. And so I'm going to spend some time, and if you would like to teach, just come right on up. And I've been thinking about some of those things and wanted to spend some time discussing some of those ideas this evening. So, and part of what got me started, I'm going to have a hard time keeping my eyes off them. I don't know about the rest of you, but part of what has gotten me started over the last couple of weeks, that's okay, Tim, don't worry about it. Going to get into the sound system and then we'll all have fun. Part of what got me started was there have been a couple of things that have gone on over the last couple of months that have really caught my attention, caught my interest, and I wanted to go over a couple of those things and just give you some background. A couple months ago, I guess it was probably a month or two ago, I was driving down to Florence. There's a guy that I like to shoot shotguns with. He's a guy, an English gentleman, who is just a brilliant, brilliant guy. He's got, when you visit his house, he's got 8 or 9 patents up on the wall. He's done a whole bunch of genome research, whatever the heck that is. Just a brilliant guy. Used to work down in the Bay Area in a lab down there. I met him earlier this year when I started going down to a range to shoot shotguns. And I was riding with him down to Florence for a match down there. And as we were riding, we just had a delightful conversation, thoroughly enjoyed it, very relaxed, very fun. We talked about all sorts of things, his background. He grew up in England, was living in London as a young boy during the World War II, basically when London was being bombed. And so we talked about some of those experiences, about his family upbringing. We talked about music that we both liked, about movies, books, all sorts of things. And on the way back, we got into a discussion about religion. Big mistake. Actually, it wasn't a mistake at all. It was fun. I enjoyed it. Again, he's just a delightful individual. But as part of the discussion, he really wanted to have me read, really wanted me to focus some attention on a book that came out 3 years ago by Christopher Hitchens entitled God Is Not Great. I don't know if any of you have read it, any of you have read any reviews on it or anything like that, but my friend David really wanted me to take a look at this book because in his mind, this book would clearly, unequivocally debunk any sort of crazy ideas that I had about religion. He observed, really, he was a little bit smug about it, quite honestly, when he observed that he had loaned the book earlier, a couple of years, it was about a year ago, he had loaned it to a woman who was a friend of his, who was a Christian, and in his mind, she didn't dare read the book, because the book was so convincing in his mind and was such a great argument that he was convinced that she didn't dare read it, otherwise she would lose her faith. She would give up her faith if she read the book. And it was really kind of funny because as we got back to his place and I was getting ready to get back in my car and head home, I said to him, I said, well, you know, could I borrow the book? And he said, well, are you gonna read it? And I said to him, well, I've got, you know, some other books on my shelf that I'm trying to read right now, but I'd like to take a look at it. And he, again, very smugly observed to me, well, I'm not going to loan it to you because you'd never read it anyway. I mean, now he wasn't being hostile. This was just him. So don't misunderstand, David. It was, again, it was a very interesting conversation, but he was just convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that this book would absolutely shatter the belief system of anyone who read it, who espoused any sort of adherence, certainly to biblical Christianity, but in his mind, it held true for anybody with any religious beliefs. If one was naive enough to believe in God, unlike his belief system as a scientist, if one was naive enough to believe in God, well, then this book would absolutely shatter and debunk all of their beliefs at that point. That was his conviction. Well, nobody challenges me and gets away with it. So I so I went out to a used bookstore. I didn't want to buy it at a new bookstore, but I went out to a good used bookstore, found the book, picked it up, and I've made my way probably a third of the way through it at this point. Haven't finished the book. Maybe it will get better. But I'm waiting for the movie to come out. But I've read the book, or I read part of the book anyway, and what I was struck by is how angry this author is, how petulant he is, how poor are his arguments, how gratuitous are his insults. I mean, it was really quite striking to me. Part of the conversation with David that was also striking to me and made me realize that sometimes we live in just different worlds from the people with whom we associate was, as we were talking about things, he said to me, he said, now have you ever read Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis? And I said, yeah, I read it back in college. He said, what'd you think of it? And I said, I loved it. I thought it was very interesting. Thought it was great. He said, I read it. I just thought it was a bunch of nonsense. I mean, he just went on and on about what nonsense C.S. Lewis was, but how very truthful was Christopher Hitchens in writing this book. Very interesting experience, and I went back and did a little bit of research on the book. Like I said, it was written in 2007, came out in 2007 rather, was published, and within a week, it was number two on the New York Times bestseller list. So a lot of other people in the country and in the world thought it was a pretty good book also. Number two on the New York Times bestseller list, right behind that other theological book, Harry Potter and the Hallows of Death, or the Death Hallows, I can't remember what it was. But he came out as a bestseller within 3 weeks. He was number one on the bestseller list. People have talked about that being on a par with Bertrand Russell's Why I Am Not a Christian in terms of the way it would just so thoroughly shake organized religion and so thoroughly shake Christianity. And yet as I read it, what I was struck by was just trying to understand how is it that someone would work so hard, whether it was Christopher Hitchens or whether it was my friend David, how is it that someone would work so hard and go to such great lengths to not believe any sort of truth or understanding about who God is? Go to such great lengths to try and dispense with any sort of conviction about who God is. Well, then, more recently here in the last couple of days, I don't know if you folks know that Stephen Hawking has come out with a new book also recently. It's called The Grand Design, and I wanted to read from you a little bit of a quote from a BBC article about a discussion with Stephen Hawking and about the book, because Stephen Hawking, the idea that has sort of caught the attention of the press right now is that Stephen Hawking asserts in that book that, and I hope I get this right, I'm not a scientist, so I hope I get this right, but basically he's asserting in the book that it is the nature of the laws of physics and of the physical world, it is the nature of those things that spontaneous creation had to have happened. God is completely unnecessary. God need not even be brought into the discussion or made a part of the picture because the laws of physics and the laws of nature are such that creation had to happen spontaneously without any of this nonsense about God. So let me just read to you a little bit from this article, and some of it are quotes from him, some of it are observations, but the article has this to say. He says, the article says, citing the 1992 discovery of a planet orbiting a star other than our sun, other than our own sun, Hawking said, that makes the coincidences of our planetary conditions, the single sun, the likely combination of Earth-Sun distance and solar mass, far less remarkable and far less compelling as evidence that the Earth was carefully designed just to please us human beings. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about when I talk about someone being smug, sort of a gratuitous sort of insult tossed out there. He adds, because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing. It is the reason why the universe exists, why we exist. It is not necessary to invoke God to light the blue touch paper and set the universe going. In his 1988 bestseller, A Brief History of Time, Professor Hawking appeared to accept the role of God in the creation of the universe. He said, if we discover a complete theory, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we would know the mind of God. Well, the other thing I found striking in the article, the BBC article, was that the BBC trotted out the obligatory English bishop from the Church of England to respond to Stephen Hawking, and at least the quote from the bishop, I don't want to do any injustice to his observations because I didn't hear all of them, but at least the quote from the bishop was singularly unhelpful. Because the bishop basically was ready to say, okay, over here we have scientific knowledge. This is the sort of thing that Charlie has been writing about and that that the folks at Gutenberg have been talking about for years, this misunderstanding that we have scientific knowledge over here, and that's how people know what is really true, and then over here we have faith. And what the bishop seemed to be suggesting is, well, if only Professor Hawking looked at things through the eyes of faith, was the phrase he used, he would understand things. But you really can't, seemed to be suggesting, you really can't combine the two, and that faith is, again, as has often been talked about here, for this particular bishop, he seemed to be saying that faith is just another way of knowing what is true. Science is one way, and faith is another way, rather than the bishop coming out and acknowledging that truth is truth, no matter where it comes from, no matter how we come to know it and how we come to understand it, truth is truth. So he seemed to me as though he sort of played into the hands of the argument there by basically suggesting that religion over here deals with things that aren't necessarily rational and understandable and aren't necessarily true in the same way that science sees things as being true. Well, that's a second thing that just has gone on recently. But then the other thing that has gone on over the last couple months, and I have to kind of show my true colors here. The other thing that has gone on for the last couple months is I am so tired of the silliness and the nonsense that comes along every election season. When you see politicians of both stripes, of any stripe, when you see politicians who seem to be willing to play fast and loose with the truth, who seem to be willing to change their recollection of things, seem to be willing to recolor, if you will, what has gone on. I am just so tired of that. And in my particular area, which is I work in the financial sector, I am so tired of all of the different explanations and observations from politicians and from economists about what has gone on and what is going on and how to fix it and how not to fix it. I am so tired of it, and the way people really are able and willing to play so fast and loose with their own observations, other things that they've said, things that they've done, the way that happens. I have just become so very, very tired of that going on. And then just to get very personal, to get very down to earth, I have to come to grips myself with to what degree I am willing to fudge the truth if it benefits me. To what degree am I willing to play a little bit fast and loose with things, maybe to not quite be as straightforward as I could be or should be if there seems to me to be some reason to do it. Well, my point then, what I wanted to talk about this evening, is just what is this whole business of what is truth all about? How do we, a little bit about how do we come to understand truth? How do we think about truth? And how do we think about deception, self-deception, lying, all that sort of thing? Those were the things I wanted to talk about this evening. Well, let me make some other observations, just continuing to set the stage here a little bit. First of all, I just wanted to observe, and I'm going to do a lot of reading here in my notes, so bear with me as I do that. It needs to be said that there is a certain persistence, and I would say even an inevitability or an unavoidableness, if you will, to truth. Truth simply is. Truth is apparent. Truth is observable. It is a reflection of God himself, I would suggest, and the way that he has ordered the universe. It has been expressly communicated to us, truth has been expressly communicated to us in many portions and in many ways. We know that from Hebrews. And finally in God's expression of himself in Jesus. God has desired to, planned to, always endeavored to communicate truth to us. And yet, in spite of all that, it is clearly in vogue today to question, to challenge truth, indeed to avoid truth. As I was driving back and forth from Boise this last week, I pulled out, there was an old tape of Jack's, and I'm looking at the tape and I'm saying to myself, okay, it's a cassette tape, mind you, it's not a CD, so you know how old it is. And Case and I have been moving, I'm saying to myself, okay, do I toss it or do I listen to it? Well, I listened to it. I'd listened to it before. I listened to it again. Excellent talk that Jack did a couple of years ago for McKenzie Study Center on Tuesday night. He did a talk entitled A Brief History of Truth. And in that talk, Jack, he gave it several years ago, he sort of traced a history of the development of philosophy and philosophy as it deals with this whole notion of truth. And what he suggested is that up until Descartes, there was sort of a common sense view of truth. Truth conformed to reality. You could make observations, look at things, touch things, and truth conformed to reality in some very real sense. But beginning with Descartes, there was a suggestion that there was not a one-to-one correlation between truth and reality. Now, you got to understand, we're talking philosophy in here, so I am like way over my head at this point. So I'm just going to try to recount as best I can what I understood Jack to be saying. And then if you have questions, we'll ask Jack. Rather, Descartes had the understanding that truth was linked to an idea or a concept that did not necessarily reflect reality directly. He seemed to be convinced that anything that could be doubted must not be true. Well, obviously, if you go down that path with that belief system that anything that can be doubted must in fact not be true. If you go down that path, then logically one ends up, for all practical purposes, with no truth at all. Because with just a little bit of creativity, with a little bit of thought, I can figure out how to doubt anything, as could each of you. That's what Descartes did. He opened the door then to all manner of skepticism, all manner of questioning of the nature of truth and whether or not truth could be known and how it could be known. He opened that door. We saw that that others followed who walked through that door. David Hume, Immanuel Kant, others went through that door. Indeed, I would suggest to you, and I've seen this over the years with students, I would suggest to you that by the end of fall term, there will be yet another batch of University of Oregon students who are going to not only question whether or not truth can be known, they will at that point be questioning whether or not they exist. That is just what happens when one gets into philosophy for the first time. And so we'll be seeing that coming out of the University of Oregon. I figure as long as they don't question whether or not the ducks exist, they'll be fine. But they will indeed be questioning those things. We went through this with, not with our own kids particularly, but with other family members who they're going through basic philosophy, and at the point at which they're seriously talking with you and wondering whether or not they exist, that's the path that Descartes sent us down and that Hume and others took us down as well. Well, there's a contemporary of Hume's, Thomas Reid, who was the founder of the Scottish School of Common Sense, and I gotta love it just because of the name. I mean, just the School of Common Sense, I gotta love it just for that reason, if nothing else. In contrast to Hume and to others who insisted that we cannot know anything about the realities of the world. All we can know are the ideas in our world, or the ideas in our mind, rather. In contrast to those things, Thomas Reid tried to bring philosophy back to more of a common sense understanding of what truth was all about, directly related to reality. But it was not the thinking of Thomas Reid that carried the day. Rather, it was the thinking of the skeptics that carried the day. In modern culture now, we have the conviction that truth really is not knowable. Indeed, we're at the point now where in this postmodern world, with so many young people today, it isn't even a matter of whether or not truth is knowable or how to know truth. They're now convinced in many respects that truth simply does not exist. That's the point that we've come to. Most 20-year-olds in our culture simply aren't wrestling with how to know the truth. They're steeped in the conviction that there is no truth. And I would suggest that in many respects, it's no wonder that 20-year-olds have gotten to this point. It's no wonder that they're questioning that, whether or not truth even exists, because on so many fronts, they're confronted with a disappointment if, in fact, they are inclined to look for truth and try to understand what's truth. On so many fronts, they're confronted with disappointment. In our culture today, there are voices that proclaim there is no ultimate truth, or perhaps even worse, in our culture, they proclaim that ideas that simply contradict and contravene any common sense, sensible understanding of what truth is all about. People are fed a steady diet of lies, which we get from all sides in our country, and after a while, one simply, I would suggest, gets tired of trying to figure out what the truth is, and eventually simply goes along with whatever is the prevailing opinion in a given area. There are a couple of cultural phenomena that I wanted to mention in briefly as we're talking about sort of how we've gotten to this point. One of which, the first thing I wanted to talk about is a movie that I have to admit is a movie that I just loved watching back in 1999, The Matrix. I don't know, again, how many of you folks have watched the movie. When the movie first came out, I have to admit, it both fascinated and horrified me. And my son insists that we didn't let him watch it back in 1999. I don't remember if it was quite that cut and dry that we didn't let him watch it or not, but certainly the minute he was out of the household, he watched it. I'll tell you what. But it fascinated me because the movie presents such an intriguing and such a stretching thought exercise in trying to follow the plot. First of all, it's an interesting plot. and then to understand what the heck the Wachowski brothers, if that's how you pronounce their name, what the heck they were trying to say about truth and reality. If you haven't seen the movie, basically the plot of the movie is in the opening scene, you're looking at what you perceive to be a real situation, a real individual, and what you come to find out in the course of the movie is what he thinks is real is not real. There's basically an alternate existence, an alternate reality that is the real world, and it isn't the world that we think is the real world that that he's inhabiting. So trying to figure out exactly what these folks were trying to communicate was interesting. The movie, however, was horrifying to me because it either shaped or reflected, I'm not sure which, it either shaped or reflected the beliefs of so many young people at that time who became convinced, perhaps prior to that time, and I don't have any idea how much influence that movie had or how much the movie simply reflected what people were thinking, but young people were convinced, and to a large degree are still convinced, that reality simply doesn't exist as we know it. And we can't know what reality is. We can't, in that sense, know what truth is all about. So I loved the movie. It was fascinating to me. But it is a scary commentary about how people think about truth these days. Indeed, when people are... I went to the wrong spot in the notes there. One of the things that that I do... think is a little bit funny with regard to the Matrix movies. They made the first one, which was outstanding. They made the second one. Oh, come on, you're really stretching it here a little bit. I thought anyway, the first one I didn't even go to see, but my thought afterwards was that the real reality for the Wachowski brothers, the real reality for them was how much money could they make on this series before they ran out the string there. So. But the Matrix, in many respects, was just a very important movie at its time. At the same time, with regard to cultural phenomena, we have children who, and this has been true of every generation. This isn't just recently. This is true of every generation. Children grow up, and as they grow up, they come to realize that there are many things that their parents tell them that simply aren't true. It might be something that that the parents simply repeat from what their parents had said. It might be some bit of cultural folklore that is passed down. But how often parents repeat something that they've been told or that they've heard or picked up somewhere, and at some point the child figures out mom and dad don't necessarily know what they're talking about. And that, in my mind, also is something that really has got to be a very shaping influence for a young person when they begin to understand that this person whom I have trusted and whom I have believed will communicate to me what is true doesn't necessarily know what is true. I think that sort of thing, that sort of influence also causes people to begin to question what is true and whether or not truth can be known. And then, unfortunately, what has happened on the individual level has also happened on the institutional level. When we have in our churches, and I'm speaking specifically of the truth of biblical Christianity here, when we have our churches all too often suggest to someone that they need to believe something even if it does not seem rational to them, and they're told that they need to accept this on faith. They're told, again, I had alluded to this earlier, they're told that there are some things that you can't be expected to understand, that you can't reasonably ask about or wonder about. You simply have to accept them on faith. Well, that suggests to me that the church likewise has done a disservice to our society, to our culture, when we suggest that there are some things that we shouldn't even make inquiry about. That I think is going to question, or is going to cause one to question what really is true. And is it true simply because someone says it's true or because it's reasonable, because it makes sense? Well, then, given a background like that, it's no surprise when Christopher Hitchens proclaims that God is not great. It's no surprise that a lot of people agree with him, enough people agree with him to push the book to the top of the Times bestseller list. The book has become sort of an evidence that demands a verdict for God haters. If you want an apology or a manual on apologetics for those who hate religion and for those who hate God, well, Christopher Hitchens' book is a good place to start. It's no surprise also that Stephen Hawking can loudly assert that the laws of nature would inevitably result in spontaneous creation of the material world, and he then goes on the talk show circuit because everybody wants to hear what he has to say. It's no surprise that those sorts of ideas permeate our culture at this point. So where do we start when it comes time to wrestle with truth and wrestle with an understanding of what is true? Well, obviously we need to start with God. I would suggest that is because God is the author, the source of all truth, the source of all reality, and thus all of the created order reflects to some degree who God is and reflects what God wants to communicate. So if one challenges or rejects truth, one is most fundamentally challenging and rejecting God. Indeed, the truth of God, I would say, is unavoidable, self-evident. And just to look at a couple of passages, and I always hate to do this because the worst thing in the world is when someone proof texts, is when someone jumps around the Bible and says, well, look at this verse and look at this verse. So pardon me, because that's exactly what I'm going to do. But I just wanted to look at a couple of different passages here that talk about some of these ideas. In Romans, Paul expresses the notion that God has revealed himself in such a way that some truth about God is unambiguously communicated. He makes this observation in Romans 1:18 through 23. We're familiar with the passage. I'm going to read it again. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through that which has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to become to be wise, they became fools. And they exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Well, I would suggest that passage is telling us that something of who God is communicated to us unambiguously, intentionally by God. So there is some understanding of truth that is readily available to each of us, to the point that Paul's observation here is that those who reject that are without excuse. In Hebrews 11, verse 6, as Paul is making an observation about sort of the way things have aligned in the universe, and that is the way one seeks to have a relationship with God, in Hebrews 11, verse 6, Paul says, without faith, it is, and we've talked about this at Reformation Fellowship over the years, faith is simply belief. Belief is simply adhering to and embracing what is true. Faith isn't a different way of knowing things. So Paul says, without faith, it is impossible to please God, for he who comes to God must believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. So the starting point in knowing what's true is to seek to understand who God is and to pursue an understanding of who God is. And then obviously there's the biblical account of the beginning of all things in Genesis 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God. That's the starting point in my mind for any discussion of truth and of what is true. Romans 19 is a devotional message, I would suggest, that affirms Paul's observation in Romans that the created order does, in some respects, express something of who God is, of God's character, of God's nature. Then on the other hand, or on the other end of the spectrum, if you will, you have those who align themselves against God and against his purposes and against any sort of understanding of biblical truth. John talks about folks like that in his gospel, John 8, verse 44, when he says, "You are of your father the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. Whenever he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own nature, for he is a liar and the father of lies." And then Jeremiah makes this interesting observation about what happens when one rejects truth and when one rebels against God. And he says this, "You shall say to them, 'This is the nation that did not obey the voice of the Lord their God or accept correction. Truth has perished and has been cut off from their mouth.'" Well, with all that as sort of background and introduction to what I wanted to talk about, I wanted to make some observations about those who lie, about those who believe lies, about what that's all about. And the reason I'm doing it, I guess, is because, again, I've just been so struck by how willing some people are to lie and by how willing some people are to embrace lies. And I just wanted to sort of explore some thoughts and ideas about the dynamics going on there. First of all, I wanted to suggest that lying, believing in a lie, both those things basically constitute the ultimate rebellion against God, as well as the willingness to replace the truth of God with a lie. If indeed God is truth and speaks only truth and has ordered all of reality to reflect that truth, then to either propagate or embrace a lie is to reject God at a very fundamental level. That's most obviously evident in the Garden of Eden and in the interaction between Adam and Eve and the serpent. In that account, the serpent speaks to Eve and challenges the content of what God has told her. She affirmed the content of what God had told her, and then the serpent directly contradicted what God had said and offered an alternative that challenged both the integrity and the character of God, and asking Eve... The serpent obviously was rebelling against God and against God's truth and asking Eve to do the same thing. She knew what was true. She was able to affirm what God had said, and then the serpent directly contradicted that and asked her to embrace that. The deception began with the serpent's determination to lie and then with Eve's willingness to be lied to. See, it always takes two to tango. You've got the liar, but if people are willing to embrace the lie, they're every bit as culpable as the liar. So Eve's willingness to be lied to and with her desire for something that appealed to her and for something that would seemingly keep her from needing to submit to God. And you'll remember the phrases that you find in the Genesis account. The serpent said to the woman, "You surely will not die, for God knows that in the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from its fruit and ate. And she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. So you have the liar, and then you have the individuals willing to accept and embrace that lie, number one, because there was something pleasurable about it. They looked at the fruit, they saw that it was good to eat. And number two, because it gave them a rationale, albeit a very poor rationale, but it gave them a rationale to refuse to submit to God, to refuse to submit to his authority and to step out from under any sort of submission to God. Well, that, in my mind, is a blueprint for all lying and all deception. That is the willingness to rebel against God and the willing pursuit of something that one wants to have but that God either cannot or will not provide. For some reason, that they think God cannot, or that they're convinced God will not provide. Well, the second point that I want to make is that some people espouse lies, and this is obvious, we see this all around us all the time. Some people espouse lies because it allows them to maintain power and influence. It's obvious that this is true, it still bears repeating though. And that is, to me, what is just the most galling about all that is going on in the political season, to know that people are unwilling to express what is true because of the desire to get elected. And again, I'm talking about people from both parties. But that willingness to do that in order to maintain power, in order to maintain influence. And that's not only evident in the political world, but that's evident in a number of other places as well. I have to admit, I am certainly capable of fudging the truth if it means I gain some edge or advantage, if you will, over my wife. I mean, that is something I think that we all have to deal with. If I just fudge a little bit, will I not get in trouble, or will I not have to do the dishes, or whatever the case may be? That's something I think every one of us individually have to deal with. We see bosses at work who are willing to tell lies in order to maintain their structure, their authority at work. We see parents who are willing to play fast and loose with the truth in order to try to maintain order in the household. We see pastors with their churches who play fast and loose with the truth in order to maintain their authority in the congregation. We see people in service jobs and in the workplace who might very well tell a lie in order to avoid doing an unpleasant task, or in order to avoid getting in trouble about something, or perhaps even simply because they don't want to help the person that they're dealing with. So we see all around us situations where people are willing to tell a lie in order to gain some advantage, or in order to retain some position, some power, some authority. Another point that I wanted to make is that people believe lies oftentimes because it absolves them in their mind of some sort of moral responsibility. As human beings, we know what we want to do, and we want to do what we want to do, even if that will end up being harmful to someone else. So we might very well be willing to believe a lie in order to do what we want to do. Phrases that come to mind in situations like this are when someone says, "Well, I'm not hurting anyone else," or when someone says, "We're both adults." If someone says, "No one will ever find out," or "I can fix it later," or "I have a right to," fill in the blank. When people say things like that, they're often willing to depart from what they know to be true in order to do what they want to do. That is often the source of lies in the lives of people. When old-fashioned truth and morality get in the way of us doing what we want to do, we are quick to concoct and or embrace a lie in order to be able to proceed with following our own desires. Another point is that people oftentimes believe lies because believing a lie is easier to do than the hard work of trying to figure out what's true. People believe they believe lies because those lies perhaps line up with what they have always been told. All of us have just a huge repository of information that we've been given over the years, what we were taught when we were growing up, what we learned in school, what we've read about. We have a huge repository of information. And oftentimes it is easier to just go along with an old belief system rather than make an attempt to reconstruct that and to work through what is really true. It's a massive undertaking to deconstruct that system, to deconstruct those things and sort out the truth. It takes time. It takes a willingness to admit that one might have been wrong in the past. And that's hard for any of us to ever have to admit something like that. It takes a willingness to admit that one might have been wrong. Both of those things, the time and that willingness, are things that are all too often in short supply right now. The picture that I had in my mind is it's when you get someone going down the path that they've always been on, trying to get them to turn around is a lot like trying to turn a battleship, cause a battleship to do a U-turn in the middle of Coburg Road or something like that. It is just tough with all the momentum, with everything going in one direction. It's tough to get the momentum changed and do the hard work of reworking things at all. That, however, and I have to throw in a pitch for Gutenberg here, that is what I love about a Gutenberg education. That is what so thrills me about a Gutenberg education. We see a Gutenberg education in many respects as a four-year process where roughly half the process is spent challenging one's assumptions and one's accepted understanding of things while at the same time giving an individual the critical thinking skills to be able to analyze information as well as the discussion skills to be able to interact with others and hear what others have to say and toss around ideas and hammer things out with other people. Then the second half of the process, roughly, is to provide the opportunity for the student to begin to rebuild that edifice of truth, if you will, and to come to some conclusions about what the student believes, what it is they want to embrace, what it is they are convinced of, rather than simply what they have been told in the past. David often says that that this is a very messy process. It is indeed. It's a messy process. I remember when our oldest daughter came home on Christmas break, her first year at Gutenberg, and we sat down and talked with her, and as we're hearing her talk, we're thinking, okay. just trying to work through what she was saying and what she was thinking through and what she was processing. It can be a very messy process. It isn't always a successful process. There are some students who are unwilling to go down that path. There are some students, there was a student who recently dropped out of Gutenberg who seems to me as though the reason this student dropped out was because there were other things this student wanted to be doing, other desires to be pursuing, other priorities in life, and this hard, messy business of trying to wrestle with what is true just was not on the agenda for this student at that time. Well, it's a hard process, not always a successful process. However, for those who have ears to hear, to use Jesus' phrase out of the Gospels, for those who have ears to hear, it is an extremely exciting and fulfilling process. And the good news is, none of us are too old to be working on that process. You don't have to be an 18-year-old, 19-year-old going to college. None of us are too old to be working on that process of reorienting our thinking, getting rid of bad assumptions, getting rid of an incorrect understanding, and embracing what is true. Well, another point I wanted to discuss is that people often espouse and believe lies because the alternative is to embrace the reality of who God is and what he has in mind for the order of the universe. And the fact is that rebellious humanity would rather not submit to God, individuals would rather take the place of God, set God aside, and not have to submit to who God is. That's one of the big reasons, I think, why people are willing to embrace a lie. There's a fundamental bottom line in this, and that is that every one of us, if given the choice, would rather be God than submit to God. So at every turn, we have the opportunity in our own lives either to originate a lie or embrace a lie, because all of the system of this world, all of the mechanisms of our culture, all of our society, all of those things are oriented to rebelling against God. I would also say that people must be willing to be deceived in order to be deceived. They might be willing to take, or they might be willing to take the path of least resistance, or perhaps take the path of greater societal acceptance, or the path that will allow them simply to quietly continue with their own practices and belief system. For some people, it is simply a matter of an acquiescence with being deceived in order to be deceived. But the reality is they have to, I would say every individual has to be willing to be deceived if they're going to be. One cannot either be deceived or be a deceiver without making that choice. And that's directly contrary to the way that God has created us. God created us with the responsibility to choose truth in all ways, at all times. It's true for every human being, but it's part of the story that God has written for each of us who are Christians, that we are to actively and aggressively refuse to engage in deception or allow deception to go unchallenged. I would also say that we have a moral obligation to seek to understand what is true, and we cannot be allowed an excuse for avoiding to understand what is true. We were with some friends a couple weeks ago, and one of the friends was talking about his mother And he was talking about the fact that she is so completely and thoroughly set in her ways that no matter of discussion, no matter of laying out other ideas, other facts, no matter of any sort of reasoning will dissuade her from being set in her ways. She seemed to be completely unwilling to change her views in spite of any evidence to the contrary, or even in spite of the careful, thoughtful arguments of her own son in that case. None of those things seemed to be a matter, or seemed to matter. In a situation like that, it's my temptation to say, to make an excuse and to say, well, she's older. Well, she's just a product of her circumstances, a product of what she's grown up with. But the reality is, I would suggest, every one of us is responsible for a choice as to whether or not we will pursue what is true or whether we will simply get along with the life without engaging in that dialogue and engaging with that that task. I'm convinced that we simply cannot just excuse ourselves or excuse others. I believe that if we are to more accurately reflect what it means to be made in the image of God, that dictates that we must make consistent choices both to seek to know and to communicate the truth. We cannot claim to be followers of God if we are willing to lie and let lies pass unchallenged. If indeed God is truth, then we must seek to choose truth and to propagate truth at every opportunity. I'll just close with a story about a friend of mine. This is a guy that I work with. I've been working with him for a little bit over a year. I'm just really starting to get to know him a little bit more in the last couple of weeks, last couple of months. We work in the same office. He's a young man, I'd say early 30s, maybe mid 30s, young man, black man, same profession that we're in. And I had a discussion with him a couple of days ago and heard a little bit more about his background. He grew up not knowing his father till he was 18 years of age. My friend grew up down in L.A., his father left the family before he was even born, so he didn't even know his father for 18 years. His father, as he was described to me, was not a good man. My friend had a very rough upbringing, very rough life growing up. Went off to college, and when he was in college, he embraced everything that his upbringing and his culture and his training would suggest that he embraced on a social level, on a cultural level, on a political level, on a religious level. In all those areas, he embraced that which would seem the norm given his background and given his particular cultural situation. And yet, I've told Case about some of my conversations with him over the last couple of weeks. As best I can tell, he seems to be a young man who sincerely wants to know what's true. He sincerely is willing to pursue that. He's always asking questions. He's always sitting people down and talking about things. And what do you think about that? And what do you think about this? And discussing things. He seems to sincerely want to know what's true. And the result of that over the years is that his life has gone a very different direction. He doesn't espouse the same beliefs that he had before. He doesn't have the same convictions in many respects that he had before. In his church, he has been politely, and I think it was politely from his description, he's been politely encouraged to move on to another church because his convictions about the sovereignty of God, his convictions about who God is and about the need for one to submit to who God is were just a little bit too radical in the church that he had been in for years. And so he's an individual that has made sacrifices in his own life, sacrifices with regard to his community, with regard to what some of his friends and peers tell him he should be thinking, he should be doing. He's made sacrifices in going a different direction because of his desire to pursue what was true, regardless of where that led him. My hope, my desire is that all of us will have the same the same sort of courage, the same sort of desire to pursue what's true. There are lots of reasons for us not to pursue what's true. There are lots of reasons for us to get sidetracked. There are lots of reasons other people will. Our world is full of lies and deception. Individuals around us, perhaps even we ourselves, are prone to self-deception, to fooling ourselves, to kidding ourselves. And yet there's a desire, there's a demand, if you will, for each of us being made in the image of God to be people who choose day by day to pursue and understand what's true, regardless of where that goes. So we've got a little bit of time. If you have any questions, comments, observations, I don't have any answers necessarily, but we can spend some time talking about some of those things.
One thing I think that is interesting about the garden incident with Eve and the serpent is that Adam was in the area, and he didn't say anything. And I think this is often the case in society where we see something that's wrong but are silent about it. And one thing that kind of comes to mind in American history is I think a lot of, for lack of using a better word, moral fiber, so to speak, kind of came out of the system because many people who were in the church were more doctrine-oriented about church doctrine than actual biblical belief. And I think this set apart, you know, set the environment for the 60s when so many people would see that this is just a bunch of customs, a bunch of beliefs, that there's not really any hard, fast truth in a lot of what's being said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. There, as I said, it certainly takes two to tango. There are liars, and there are those willing to be lied to, or willing to avoid confronting a lie and avoid dealing with the lie, and they're both culpable.
Yeah. So, you really kind of said what I was going to say. That I think Adam is as guilty as Eve.
Oh, yeah. I mean, certainly. I don't know just what his proximity was, but certainly when he was presented with the opportunity to eat of the fruit, when he was told not to, you didn't hear any objections from him. So absolutely culpable there, you bet.
Right, and it also speaks to human nature, too, want to stay in the group.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he didn't eat of the apple, that would mean a separation between he and Eve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's probably one reason why he did that, because he didn't want to be separated from Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why a lot of people will not accept the truth, because they don't want to be separated.
Sure. Yeah. Adhering to the truth is not necessarily a comfortable place to be. It is not necessarily an accepted position for one to put themselves in by any means.
Yeah. I have a friend that... we've talked sometimes about certain things, and he's one that's, I can almost say, intellectually lazy, so to speak. And I've told him, you know, having knowledge and so on is not really a comforting proposition, because having knowledge allows you to understand things better, and also often you can see things that are not true or not right better. And it's not exactly fun to have these realizations.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
I just have an observation. I've been thinking a lot about the concept of tolerance in our society, related to the burning of the Quran and building of the mosque and all those issues that are current. And it seems like the definition of tolerance has been a rejection of the definition of truth. Like, we're considered tolerant if we say, well, my truth is mine and your truth is yours, and so I'm tolerant of you because it doesn't really matter what you believe. And it seems like we won't ever come to a place where we can be tolerant of other people's beliefs until we say tolerance is you can believe your whatever you want to believe, but I know what I believe. Mm-hmm. I know what the truth is. And it just, I don't know, I just feel like we need to have a new definition of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point. It certainly is true in our culture today that there is not much room for one to have strong convictions about things. One who has strong convictions about things is
intolerant.
By definition intolerant, and any sort of other names that might be applied to them. And that's the level of the dialogue has been lowered so much. One cannot carry on a discussion without names being thrown around and people being disparaged. It's a very low state of affairs right now. So,
here you go, Peter. Right and wrong, subset of truth, or I think it's implicit maybe, and when you talk about truth, sometimes it sounds like we could substitute right.
Sure.
For that. But subset, is that the first assessment of, if you think you've got a hold on what the truth is, you're also bound to figure out if it's a call to action to sort out right from wrong?
Yeah, I would say certainly. I mean, one, I don't know if this is what you're getting at, but one, I think, is compelled by when one comes to sort of some sort of apprehension of what's true, that compels one to some sort of response. And it may take a public form, it may not, it'll be different for different people in different situations, but certainly, yeah, when one...
So right and wrong could be subjective?
No. You're not going to catch me on that one, Scott.
Right.
No.
So it can be known, though.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, what's right and wrong can absolutely be known. And I guess all I was trying to say is there needs to be a response on the part of everyone with regard to what's right and wrong. And an embracing of what is right, and no, it's not. I mean, truth is not subjective. Right and wrong are not subjective. They're not different for different people. But the call to action might very well be different.
We might mistake them, though. We might err in our assessment.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we certainly will from time to time, you bet. And that's where how we approach truth. I mean, again, the thing I love about the Gutenberg tutors is they approach things as a learner rather than I've arrived and now let me tell you what is true and what to believe. They approach things as I'm still thinking things through and you, let's dialogue, let's talk about things, and if I'm missing the mark, convince me and let's go forward from there. So we will make mistakes, yeah.
But it does seem like it's a call to action.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks for clearing that up.
Yeah, definitely. Anybody else? Any other observations, questions?
Oh, thank you, Peter. This is really hitting the rubber meets the road for me at the moment.
Good.
So, as I'm just starting off looking at the works of Plato, I've been really getting the idea of dialectic and being in the process. Seeing a lifelong, if not multi-lifelong, pursuit of discovery, getting a picture of how reality is, going forward with it, and finding discontinuities and think, oh, got to rethink, and then mm-hmm. returning this thesis, antithesis, synthesis, mm-hmm. Wonderful do loop. So I'm seeing that as one encounters life, that one goes forward with perceptions of what reality is and how it works, and there are going to be discontinuities that mm-hmm. pop up.
Mm-hmm.
And leaning back to the film of Matrix, there were major discontinuities that were in that world or that perception of reality. The case is the guy sitting in his cubicle gets a cell phone in a FedEx box, picks it up and says, duck, or however it was, in which case major discontinuity, okay, this is new information, what I've been thinking was reality really isn't. This warrants further investigation. Mm-hmm. And in the face of discontinuity, one can either choose to ignore it, in which case you're just back where it is, rather than, ooh, this is a discontinuity. I need to pay attention to this. Mm-hmm. I need to work, do the hard work to rehash, rethink. And that takes a heck of a lot of courage.
Mm-hmm. Certainly does. Yeah, and it really is then a lifelong process going through that and doing that. I have to admit sometimes my brain gets kind of tired because it's a long, arduous process, but it's an important process.
Cool. Thanks.
You bet.
I feel compelled back in my corner to just speak a word for tolerance. Probably get me in trouble, but I think that in these times when so much about religion is coming to the fore because of the events around 9/11, that we need, I think, to be in our spiritual lives and in our church family as strongly rooted and as sure as we can be about what we believe. But we need to not forget that a little tiny outfit like this one, which meets together without the endorsement of any major denomination or the good housekeeping seal of approval, we are able to do that because we live in one of the more religiously tolerant countries in the world. And part of the price we pay for the fact that we don't have to check with anybody and we don't have to get any approval to meet with 100 other people when nobody else necessarily agrees with us is that we have to tolerate people who disagree with us. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that unless, especially when it comes, practically, like with this mosque business, I'm not thrilled that that's what they want to do. I think it's a bad idea. However, unless we tell people we will not allow a church or a synagogue or any other place of worship within X amount of distance of that site, we really risk what it means to be the United States of America and the freedoms that we have if we tell one group they can't do it. Mm-hmm. Not unless we know that that group flew airplanes into those buildings. I mean, that's something different. But we know in our heart of hearts, just like I cringe when I see our gun-packing pastor down in Florida, and I say, boy, I hope nobody thinks that's my Christianity. Mm-hmm. There are people in that religion who cringe at what their radical Islamist, politically motivated, not religiously motivated fellows have done. Mm-hmm. And to brand them all as people that we want to drive out of our communities because of those guys is intolerance at its worst, in mm-hmm. my view.
Yeah, I don't think you would find virtually any disagreement from me on what you're saying. What I object to is when society's definition of tolerance is that I am not allowed to believe what I believe. I'm not allowed to think what I think. It doesn't necessarily have to do with actions. It has to do with, in our society, really, truly, in many respects, by their definition, I am not tolerant if I believe what I believe. And that's where I call into question the current idea of tolerance.
I agree. So. It does seem like we're tolerant nowadays of everything except Christianity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's very true. Yep. I thought we were going to get out of here early, but... Oh, that's right. So interesting. Thanks, Logan.
Well, I just want to hitchhike on what John said. It seems to me that the what do you call it? Quran burning uh-huh. thing. I was half tempted to come and burn a Bible today. And the reason being, I mean, to make the point, is that where the whole tolerance thing comes in is... It's not enough that we respect and allow people to disagree with us in this country. We're supposed to say they're also peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
That all religions are ultimately peaceful religions, and Christianity is a peaceful religion, and Islam is a peaceful religion. Well, history suggests no, it's not. And it seems to me the proof of that is if you burn a Quran, you will get bullied. If you burn a Bible, contrary to what a lot of people have said publicly, I'm not going to riot if somebody burns the Bible, because as Christians, we believe that it's true. It's not a superstitious belief about some ink on a piece of paper, and that if you burn the Bible, you have committed the unforgivable sin, and this is just a complete outrage. It's just a book. Mm-hmm. It's just paper with ink on it. The truth transcends any book. But I'm not sure it does for Islam, and they're going to bully you into not believing otherwise. Mm-hmm. So I think the question is worth raising to the Muslims in the world. Really? Your God is so weak and so small, and your book is so powerless that if somebody burns it, you're threatened by it. Maybe you better rethink your religion. Hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, to hitchhike on what was just said, a couple of things to remember is the fact that the Muslim religion and the Quran very clearly say that they will take over the world and that no other religion is acceptable. And in the last 10 years, the Muslim religion has been the fastest growing religion in the world.
Okay, last, you missed it, Marianne, last comment here.
I'm obviously new. I guess I won't be as articulate as anyone here. that much is I know for sure. I guess I'm curious as a newcomer as to whether if I came back I should expect that the discussion will always be political. I'm not entirely sure. It doesn't seem like anybody here is Muslim, or that anyone here really knows how a moderate Muslim or a radical, as it was put to me that this group is, would feel about burning the Quran. That's it.
Interesting questions, observations. I would suggest that if you are here 51 out of 52 weeks, you would not hear a political discussion. It'll be generally speaking, there's a rotating team of teachers. In a couple weeks, we'll be starting Romans. We have been going through the Sermon on the Mount. When David teaches, he teaches out of 1st or 2nd Samuel. So that's the norm. It's just when you get a substitute that you... But the other observation is worth thinking about. So, well, 6 o'clock, we're done. Thank you all very much, and we will see you next week.